I'd like now to welcome to the program writer E.J. Levy. Her new book is called Amazon's A Love Story, and she will be speaking on Tuesday, the 16th of October at 7 o'clock at the Randall Davey Audubon Center on Upper Canyon Road here in Santa Fe, sponsored by Amigos Bravos. Welcome, E.J., to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It is an honor and a privilege to be talking to you.
So this is a really interesting memoir to me because it's not only about a young woman. The book covers the time in your life when you were about sort of 21 years old. And it's not only about a young woman trying to do her part to save the Amazon rainforest, but also really about what it's like to be young and starting out and making mistakes. And it is so vivid for me in that way. But let's talk first. What drew you to Brazil in the first place? It was the early 1980s.
It's really kind of you to ask. I think I was very naive. I was coming out of Minnesota and a very fine public school system where we were studying Shakespeare and poetry and Aristotle and Plato, but nobody was talking about what was going on in Central and South America. And, you know, Latin America was just not on the map in a way. And so I was really radicalized by the first history course I took at college, where I saw images of the bodies of peasants who'd been torn in half and left, I mean, the kind of stem of a spine emerging from a pair of pants of a man who'd been killed by the Somoza guards in Nicaragua, whose installation we had backed. And from there, I started reading about at a great teacher of history who was Brazilian. So through him was learning about, broadly, Latin American history and U.S. involvement in that, but then more particularly started reading about Amazonian deforestation. And this was the 80s when nobody was talking about global warming except, you know, a pack of scientists who were working in different places around the world, one of them being the National Institute for Amazonian Research in Manaus, Amazonas, Brazil. And I just felt like it was one of those moral issues that I was convinced if people knew about it, they would act. We could stop it. I think there were a lot of people who felt that way. I think there are a lot of young people on campuses now who feel that way, that if only we were aware, we would take action. So it was really both that reading that got me engaged intellectually, and more personally, I'd spent a summer in Brazil right out of high school and had lived with a family in the very southern state of Brazil, Rio Grande do Sul, and so had also a kind of romantic attachment in that cliched way, had gone abroad, fallen in love, thought I'd found the person I would marry. And so there were, it was kind of twofold, the sources for my interest in Brazil and particularly in Amazonian protection.
So you landed in Salvador, Bahia, which was maybe an odd place to go before you went to the Amazon. Why did you start there?
The fellowship office, it was a very generous fellowship, but they sent me to the wrong place. So it was a little bit like getting a fellowship to go study, oh, I don't know, the Hudson River and being sent to New Orleans, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, it was a fascinating place to be. It's really where kind of the old world of West Africa meets the new world, and lots of people talk about Salvador Bahia as the African capital in the new world. There are Afro-Brazilian religious cults that still exist in only two places in the world, in Angola and in Bahia. So it was really a terrific place to be, but very far from what I'd come to study, which was sustainable development projects in the Brazilian Amazon, ideally at the National Institute of Amazonian Research, which where I eventually got after some effort.
And so you spent some time there, at least at the beginning, trying to learn Portuguese and making friends and just learning your way around the country. And it was so, I mean, I was reading this book and I was so identifying with it, remembering what it was like to be that age when you go abroad to be in a foreign place, being kind of uncomfortable in your own skin the way you aren't when you get older and kind of find your direction in life. And I wondered, what was it like for you to just write this, to remember this time, which is now several decades back?
It's good of you to be so sympathetic toward that. It was really hard, actually, to write this because for me, there was a kind of crossing point. At 25, I fell in love with a woman and came out, and my whole life changed. I sort of fell back into my body, having vacated the premises at about, you know, like 12 or 15 or something. So that whole period of when I was a young student in Brazil, really ill-equipped for the trials of a pretty rough town and life, that when I got back from the year in Brazil, I pretty much turned my back on Latin American studies and walked away from the person I'd been. And so to try to write about it from the vantage point of my late 30s, early 40s, was really a wonderfully kind of reclamative thing. I was surprised at how vividly it all came back to me. I also kept a lot of journals and things and took some notes right after I had returned. So I had a lot of kind of archival material to go back to. But I was amazed at how whole and vivid that period was, because I just closed the door. As you know from the book, a good friend of mine there ended up becoming a prostitute. I ended up being assaulted, you know, raped. And for somebody as naive and idealistic as I was coming out of Minnesota, it was pretty shocking, and it was easy to walk away. But I think, as with the kind of environmental crises we're facing now, we need to turn and look at all this head on, look at the damage head on, if we're going to do something about it.
Well, I think one of the things that is so interesting, and people who are reading the book, we're talking about Amazon's A Love Story, people reading the book kind of have to do this for themselves, but there is a kind of interweaving between the damage people do to each other and the damage that people do to nature. And I don't know that you make it explicit, but it kind of invites us to think about that.
You're wonderful. Yeah, thank you. You're like my ideal reader, you know. But I guess I think we're talking, as we should be, a lot about the damage we're doing to the environment these days. But I wanted to try to look at the damage a certain kind of logic, a certain kind of marketplace logic does to each of us, you know, to our individual, to our intimate lives, to our relationship, not just with nature, but with ourselves and with each other. So thank you for seeing that. I mean, the book is less about personal trauma, as it were, I hope, than about a kind of diagnosis of a phase of history, as the Steven Spender quote that starts the book suggests.
We're talking to E.J. Levy, and without giving too much away, there is a moment where you get to confront the person who assaulted you, and I didn't, as I was reading along, I never thought that that could possibly happen, although one always hopes that it does, because it's so cinematic, and you actually got to do it.
Yeah, it was really great fun, you know, and there was a sense of coming into, like, my inner New Yorker or something, claiming my
right.
inner New Yorker in the course of that year. My father's from Manhattan, my mother's from Minnesota, and I really felt like, in a way, I pivoted from somebody who thought that politeness was the key to navigating the world, to, you know, we will reasonably discuss these things, to feeling like you got to fight for what you love. And I think that's true in our politics now, too.
And it's also interesting because I think that the book is very much a portrait of where women were at that time, educated women. We'd gotten to a certain point, but no further in really claiming our own power. I think women are further along than we were then.
I think that's true. I think that's really true. And I think that, you know, we often think of sort of the 60s as this radical time, and really a lot of the legal change happened in the 70s. But I think there was a lot of still kind of revolution and consciousness that happened in the 80s that it's easy to forget. I mean, I know when I first got to college that sexual harassment wasn't a term, and I had a couple of profs, people I really admired, but who outright propositioned me, and I was certainly not alone. And so I think that there was a very different sense of what, you know, a young woman's place in the university and in the world, then I hope is true now. I mean, it seems my students now seem really much more assured of their options and much more confident of themselves as people and sexual beings, but not necessarily defined in some limited way, as I think still prevailed then. I mean, women had only been at Yale for 15 years by the time I graduated.
You did go there to Brazil, to the Amazon rainforest, with some ideals about playing a role in making things better. I mean, deforestation, as you talked about, was under discussion a great deal, although global warming not nearly so much. What did you actually end up doing there?
In some ways, less than I hoped. You know, a lot less than I hoped. What I had proposed to do that got me a fellowship to Brazil was to go and look at possible sustainable development projects for the Amazon, see what was there and what might be done. And in fact, by the time I reached the Amazon, I was so frankly messed up by having been raped and having my, you know, just being so ill-equipped for so much of what was around me that I wasn't in great shape to take on intellectual projects. But I do think that ultimately the kind of real change happens in a change in consciousness, and it certainly affected that for me. So what I ended up doing was working with the wonderful scientist Philip Fernside, who is still at the National Institute for Amazonian Research. He was a major force in Amazon protection. He still is. He's done great work in protecting the forest by mapping its loss and showing what is being lost, and therefore providing justification for better land use laws and enforcement of those laws. So what I was literally was a kind of cartographer of loss. I was helping him by translating Landsat images, satellite images, onto maps so that you could see what exactly was there and what was gone. And of course, when you're talking about an area that large, it's important to be able to define what's happening in the terrain if you're going to get anyone to fight for it. So he's done a great job.
When you look at that area now and when you read about it, do you feel like there's been any progress made either in saving land or ecosystems or in the consciousness about all of that?
I think an enormous amount of good has been done. So, I mean, there's sort of good news and bad news. The good news is that in the 9 countries that comprise the Amazon rainforest and river now, 80% still of that terrain is still intact. So 80% of the Amazon throughout all the nations that have Amazonian forest is still intact. And Brazilian deforestation is markedly down over the last 8 years. It's down by 76%. Partly, that's because there's been an economic decline that's helped slow the kind of rapacious appetite for things that were mined there or extracted in terms of hardwoods. But a lot of it also has to do with good land use law enforcement. Not all the news is great out of Brazil. There was just a massive hydroelectric project, the Belo Monte, whose development has just been approved. The Supreme Court just allowed them to begin construction in August of this year. On the other hand, in May of this year, the Brazilian government sent in almost 10,000, I guess 8,500 soldiers to help disrupt illegal mining and drug smuggling and deforestation. And so they, like, one of the things they did was find 10 illegal airstrips that they stopped in Roraima. And there are plans to increase this. So on one hand, Brazilian deforestation is markedly down, but it's going up in the Andean portion of the Amazon. So in the countries surrounding Brazil that share the Amazon, which is 40% of the Amazon, there is the sort of rapid deforestation that had been happening in Brazil a decade ago.
E.J. Levy is the author of the book Amazon's A Love Story. She will be speaking on Tuesday, the 16th of October at 7 o'clock at the Randall Davey Audubon Center on Upper Canyon Road here in Santa Fe, sponsored by Amigos Bravos. For more information, amigosbravos.org. E.J., thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You are so wonderful. Thank you for having me.
And by the way, E.J. Levy will be giving away copies of the book Amazon's A Love Story to anyone who buys a discounted membership to Amigos Bravos at the event, once again, Tuesday, the 16th of October at 7 o'clock at Randall Davey Audubon Center. And I'd like now to welcome to the program Elaine Pinkerton. Her new book is called The Goodbye Baby, A Diary About Adoption, And she will be reading from the book on Sunday, the 14th of October at 3 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. And there will be a workshop afterwards, which we'll talk about in a moment. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi there, Mary Charlotte. Great to see you.
Good to see you, too. Now, this is a memoir that you wrote based on rereading your childhood and beyond childhood diaries. What was that process like?
Well, it was rather amazing because I had tried for 23 years to write a book about being adopted, growing up adopted, and the issues and living through it and what it did to me and how I overcame it and how I could maybe help other people by sharing my journey. So I had to take a journey to the past and see firsthand what I experienced. Also, I had an ulterior motive. I didn't want the diaries to live on after me, so I had planned to destroy them to give them a proper burial, and I had to
literally burial?
I've changed. I'm going to burn.
You're
going to
cremate them?
Yes. they're on the chopping block, or yes, the funeral pyre. However, it was edifying because the way I remembered the past is not the way I recorded it. So it was pretty astonishing since I had recorded ridiculously fully everything.
So you went through these, and it's actually, it's funny that you came on the air a couple of years ago and talked about actually giving readings from people, not only your own, but various people giving readings. It turned out to be a stage reading from your diaries, which I conspicuously did not participate in because I've got these damn things on a bookshelf somewhere and I don't know what I'm ever going to do with them. But that was partly inspired by a website where people are actually doing what they call cringe readings from their teenage diaries.
Indeed. Yeah, one could just Google cringe readings. In fact, I recommend it. A very creative woman named Sarah Brown in Brooklyn, New York, inspired me way across the country thanks to the internet. And I decided that Santa Fe needed some cringe readings to just talk about the Brooklyn event, which is still going on. They meet at Freddy's, people who want to just get rid of the past, read it, laugh, cry, whatever, and share it and just move beyond it. Have these readings, and there's even a branch in London of
Amazing.
Cringe readings.
Now, do you get beyond it? I mean, when you open that stuff up and you read it aloud, or indeed you use it to write a memoir and you finish the memoir, does it get it out of your system in some way?
For me, it certainly has. I went very far with it because I realized the common thread, the arc, so to speak, in all the diaries was that I was a victim of having been adopted at age 5, of having not, of having the repressiveness of when I was adopted, not being able to talk about it, not being able to feel okay about who I was. And I carried it very far in that I was authentic in my diary, but I had to have a mask. And mine was a very impenetrable mask. And so, I just decided, okay, been there, done that, and I became the heroine of my own life.
Now, that's an interesting idea because being the heroine of your own life basically means constructing your life as a narrative. You might, 20 years from now or 20 years ago, be constructing a different narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But as it is, you are constructing this particular narrative. And it all has to do with adoption on some level. Is that right?
It does for me. It did for me. And I have discovered in talking with people that everyone has a childhood trauma of some sort. And it stays within one unless you realize how deeply it wounded you. Well, this was my sort of paradigm. I was adopted. I wasn't good enough. Therefore, I was really sad. Or I was, and my mother was a monster, and I was really mad. And it was one or the other. No in between. Because as a child, you think it's all about you. And even though I grew up and I accomplished many things and I had outwardly just a normal life with some really good accomplishments, inwardly I didn't feel okay. But now I feel pretty cured of the adoption issues.
And, I mean, reading through and even looking at that beautiful picture of you and your adoptive family at the beginning of the book, I mean, you got into a pretty good and compatible family. You look like them. They loved you. They were stable.
I did, and I was really lucky. But inside, I was always afraid of being sent back. I had been in foster homes up till age 5, and I thought, if you love somebody, and they're going to leave you. So I had abandonment issues. It sounds really hackneyed and trite, but I did have them because I had been abandoned. My birth mother did come into my life, but I waited 38 years before she came back to get me.
You actually met her later in your adulthood.
And it wasn't very satisfying because she was not parent material.
Which is why she gave you up in the first place.
And I'm really, it's a miracle she did, and I'm glad she did. And I had wonderful parents, but I didn't have a chance to work through it when I should have. So finally, many, many, many years later, I worked through it and turned it into a book that I hope will help other people dealing with those same kinds of issues.
And it draws very heavily from those diaries, which will at some point no longer exist. Now, you're also giving a workshop. What's that about?
Okay, I've titled the workshop Jumpstart Your Memoir. So I'm going to have about an hour after the book reading, the signing, about 4:30, I'll have, or 4:15, I'll have writing materials, and people can just have a hands-on opportunity to shape their own life stories or pick an episode. I've given quite a few writing workshops, so it'll just be a way for them to start thinking about, you know, harvesting their journals or family letters.
Elaine Pinkerton is author of the book The Goodbye Baby, and once again she'll be at Collected Works Bookstore this Sunday, the 14th of October at 3 in the afternoon, and there's a workshop afterwards. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's been fun being here.
I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Dr. Harry Wong. He is a teacher. He's author of the book, The First Days of School, How to Be an Effective Teacher. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here.
And I'd like to welcome Susan Herrera. She is CEO of the Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And you guys are bringing Doctors Wong to New Mexico. What's going on?
Yes, the Lytle Foundation for the last 3 years has been actively pursuing this path of student improvement through inquiry science. So we're in partnership now with 11 school districts all over northern New Mexico, and we're working with teachers and helping them develop their practice as far as teaching science. This is K through 6th grade. That's what we're working on. So we work with a group of superintendents, and what we also decided to do, we have workshops during the summer. We have a summer institute, and we train teachers during the summer institute. But we also wanted to bring to our teachers the best minds in education, the best leaders in education once a year. So we said that every year we'd have a conference, and this year's top-of-the-line speaker is Dr. Harry Wong. And believe me, last year when we announced it, I was telling Harry before when he announced it at the end of last year's conference, I said, and next year we'll have Dr. Harry Wong. The whole place just broke into applause. So teachers know who he is. They're very excited to hear from him. And, you know, with budgets being the way they are today, we don't send teachers away to conferences anymore.
Right.
So what we try to do is bring the speakers here, make our own conference, and we have about 1,400 teachers coming to see him over the next 2 days.
What is special about science teaching, and how do you teach teachers to teach science?
Okay, understand that I'm a former science teacher who now spends most of my time talking to teachers in general. So there's nothing special in terms of science. I'm here to talk about how to be a very good, effective teacher. And if you're a good, effective teacher, you can teach anything.
Now, let's talk about this then. Why is the first day or the first days of school so important?
Because how you begin, the old saying, step off on the right foot, get all the ducks lined up, that if you don't step off on the right foot, you are dead for the rest of the year. It's how you begin.
And that's where you establish a sense of, as you talk about in the book, classroom management.
Okay. The most important thing that a teacher must do is have a plan. Let me explain. I'm not making fun of teachers. What many teachers do is just cover the textbook. They think that's the curriculum. I'm going to cover chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3. I don't run this classroom. McGraw-Hill runs this classroom. And the kids all sit there saying, what's going to happen this year? What's your plan? What do you want out of us? All we're doing is sitting here watching you cover the book. And so what Rosemary, my wife, and I have done is written this book. It's called The First Days of School. It's based on the research of a University of Texas professor who says the very first week of school is the most important week of the school year. You must have a plan, you know, like businesses have business plans, coaches have game plans. All teachers must have a classroom management plan, and we're here to show the teachers on Thursday and Friday what a plan looks like and how they can create their own.
So there is something that I think was interesting. I mean, you talk about the various stages that teachers go through, and one of the early levels is survival. You've got to get past survival to lesson mastery. What does that mean?
Well, many teachers come into education, and if they have not had a good background in a college, they don't know what they do. They survive. We can say this about any profession. I'm not making fun of teachers. They will spend time surviving. And what we tend to do is get the teachers out of survival so that they will thrive and become effective teachers. And we know how to do it because the research says there are three characteristics of an effective teacher. It's all based on the research, including the research of Marzano, who was here last year. Lots of people. I'm not doing anything new. I haven't invented anything new. The three characteristics of an effective teacher are, number one, you have to know how to run and manage a classroom. And I would appreciate if you would ask me about classroom management later on, because it is the most misused and misunderstood word in education. Number two, after you have this classroom running smoothly, which is what classroom management is, you have to know how to deliver the subject matter, how to teach the subject matter, which is not covering the textbook. And number three, and I don't mean to make it number three, because in my book it's number one, the most important thing is you're walking with a wonderful attitude. We call it positive expectation, that you know that every kid's going to succeed.
It's such an interesting and important fact, I think, that if you like your teacher and you feel that your teacher believes in you, you're way more likely to actually learn anything.
That's exactly the point of having that first day, because a good teacher on the very first day of school will stand at the door and greet the kids, all right, and establishes a relationship and connection right away. You have to understand that every single day in America, 1.5 million kids come from a homeless situation. They may have no one to greet them. No one may have even said goodbye to them that morning. And here's this wonderful teacher standing at the door saying good morning to you, all right? And then the next thing they do is they walk in the classroom and there's an assigned seat. Now, there are some teachers, unfortunately, and college professors who don't believe in assigning seats. Let them sit anywhere they want to sit. Well, the research says assign them to a seat. It's not an assignment so much as I said, many of these kids come from homeless situations. They come to school, and this is their desk. The teacher has their name on it. Wow. They have materials on it. It's there. This is my place. I have no home where I come from. I come to this classroom, and it's consistent. It's stable. Then the next thing a teacher will have is what's called an agenda. Now, that's common sense, because you go to any airport, the flight schedules are posted. You come in the classroom, the kids see an agenda, which consists of three things. The schedule, so they all just know what's going to happen. They don't like surprises. We teach teachers consistency. Number two, they have a thing called bell work, which means the second they sit down, there's your assignment, get to work. Teacher doesn't have to yell at them and scream at them, tell them to sit down. They just know what to do. And number three, they see the lesson objective. They know what they're going to learn. And I don't get this question, make it wrong, what are we going to do today, you know? And so these are things we teach teachers, how to establish and organize a classroom.
Now, knowing what your agenda is and knowing what the lesson is to be learned, like let's say it's your times tables, or let's say it's algebra or something like that, that is a very clear thing that you can, that a student can master. But let's say it's critical thinking. It's much harder to evaluate. How does a teacher know whether they've succeeded, and how do they kind of put the boundaries on it, like I've succeeded in teaching the kids that?
That's my second category. How do you teach? And teach is not just subject matter. It can be, as you say, the inquiry process, the thinking process. If I could just show you one of my assignment sheets, and I call my assignment sheets your friendly helper. I'm your friendly helper to help you learn, okay? And I will show one tomorrow. And if you look at on the list, there are what we teachers call objectives. And these objectives are based on somebody named Benjamin Bloom, who said there are different levels. The most basic level is just give them the information. The highest level is what you've just talked about, how to think and solve problems. And so a good teacher will write these objectives out. And some of them are problem-solving objectives. And some of them are just straight recall. And so it's very easy to do these things. And the kids all know that in one case, I'm just going to have to memorize some state capitals. Another one, the teacher wants me to solve a problem.
We're talking to Dr. Harry Wong. So here in New Mexico, we have some of the problems. I mean, you've talked about homelessness that we have across the United States of America. And here we've got hunger, poverty, substance abuse among the parents, sometimes substance abuse among the kids, violence. And you've got these kids suddenly, okay, they're in their assigned seats, but they're coming in with problems. And then there's other kids in the same classroom who come from happy, stable homes, and they're basically fine and ready to learn. How do you manage a classroom like that?
Okay, first, tell me that the problems you've just mentioned are not unique to Santa Fe. You should know that if anyone's listening, it's the same all over the country, if not all over the world, because Rosemary and I travel all over the world. We all have the same problems, okay? And so the key is, as I said, they have to come in and succeed. That's the thing they're all looking for. No one comes to fail. They may want you to think they come to fail. They may act up. But if the more they act up, the more they're saying to you, I really want to succeed. No one's ever helped me to succeed. And so when they come into a class that I teach and the classes that I teach teachers to teach, the class is organized in such a way the kids all know what they're supposed to be doing. And then after they get to work, I walk around the room constantly and I help. Okay? The key is, and teachers know this phrase, check for understanding. See, as I said, the worst teacher is the one who just covers and covers and covers. A good teacher explains the classroom, explains some subject matter, and then walks around the room while the kids are working, constantly checking for understanding. And if they don't understand, you just help and help and help. And suddenly that kid that you've just described who may come to school with all kinds of problems looks at you with that little smile, and you know you've reached that kid.
Now, how much in the classes that you've taught throughout your lifetime, for example, a lesson is you talking to the kids and calling on them and having an interactive full classroom situation versus each child working on his or her own and you going around and checking their work, which is maybe more of a self-paced kind of thing?
Okay, let me answer that question in this way, that your question is general and I'm not avoiding the question. You see, if I were teaching a welding class, and I know welding teachers, most of it is I give you the instruction, then let me watch you and work and work and work and work. Then there are other classes, rooms, where the teachers have to do much of the presentation. So it's a case of what grade level are we talking about? What subject are we talking about? The best kind of teacher always talks and explains and shows and allows time for questions. There's interaction, and then there's always some kind of an activity, so the kids are involved. So a good teacher every single day does different things at different time levels.
And that's something, it seems almost like an art and a craft that you learn over the years.
No. You have what's called a lesson plan. You see, you walk in with a classroom management plan first. A classroom management plan tells you how you are going to manage the classroom, and I call them procedures, okay? Good teachers have lots of procedures, so kids all just know what to do. And then, as I said, an agenda has three parts. One part is the lesson objective, all right? And so a teacher will have what's called a lesson plan. What's my goal? And it may be one that you have no control over because Common Core or the state or the school district may say, you must teach this. And since you're an employee of the district, you have no choice. You must teach that, which is fine. All right, it's like this place. You must make coffee in a certain way. And then the teacher next takes that general term that's been thrown at the teacher by the state of New Mexico or the government and then turns it into an objective that the kids understand. I see what I'm supposed to be doing. Then the next thing the teacher does is to write down all the activities that I'm going to do to get the kid to understand the objective. See, in my classroom, I say to the kids, there's no mystery. This is the lesson objective. This is what I want you to learn. Now, here's the best part. I'm going to teach you the same thing. So together, we're going to arrive there. And how am I going to do it? I'm going to have you do this and this and this and this. Read this, watch this movie, and I'm going to help you learn it.
So you mentioned procedures a moment ago. What do you mean?
Okay. The most misused word in education is classroom management. You ask most teachers what classroom management is, and they think it has to do with discipline. Kids are misbehaving in the classroom. And I say to teachers, that's not the definition of classroom management. Look at the research. Marzano doesn't say that. No one else says that. Classroom management is how you manage the classroom. If you want to talk about discipline, then it's behavior management. That's chapter 18 in my book. Classroom management is chapter 19 and 20. They're two different things. You manage an apartment. You don't discipline the residents. You hire a financial manager. Can you imagine the financial manager says, now, if your dollars misbehave, I'm going to send your dollars down to the office. And so lots of teachers are so involved with discipline that that's all they do, and they never get around to what I call student learning. Classroom management is simply how you structure and organize the classroom so the kids all just know what to do. And if they know what to do, they'll do it and they'll succeed. So how do you get kids to do what you want them to do? And they're called procedures. And so I teach kids that I'm going to teach you some procedures. Now, a procedure is not a rule, because a rule is something having to do with behavior. And if you misbehave and you violate one of the rules, I'm going to have to punish you. But you are never, never punished with a procedure. For instance, I'm going to teach you the procedure of how to take lecture notes. And by the way, it's amazing how many teachers don't teach the procedure of lecture notes. And if you do it wrong, I'm not going to punish you. I'm going to teach you over and over again how to take lecture notes so that as you go through school, you'll succeed.
I never was taught that.
Yeah, it's called the Cornell note-taking system. I'm going to teach you the procedure of how to read a textbook, because I'm not just going to throw the book at you and say, read it, because all books are written in a very unique style. You know, a history book will be written differently from a sixth grade math book. I'm going to explain to you how the author structured the book. We teachers call it SQ3R. I'm going to teach you how to do homework. I get my kids, 90 to 95% of my kids turn in homework. And most teachers don't believe me. I said it's very easy. What you do is you don't allow them to go home with homework until the third week of school. We physically do the homework in class. I teach them the procedure of how to do homework. And then I have simple things like procedures of how to pass in paper. You know, I tell teachers now, the worst thing you can do is have kids pass papers forward. You know, you never do that, because what does the kid do with all the papers in his or her hand to the back of the kid sitting in front of you? You punch the kid, then you have a fight in your classroom. It's much better to pass the papers across the road. So I teach all kinds of procedures so that kids all just know what to do.
One of the things that I keep getting from what you're saying is that having stability, I mean, this is what I think everybody wants. When you talk to politicians, the populace wants stability. But especially kids who come from unstable homes, they want a place where they know how things are going to be and they can count on certain routines and that they get that consistency from the teacher.
Beautiful. You've been listening to me and you've caught the whole essence of my lecture for the next 2 days. Rosemary and I constantly talk about a culture of consistency. That's what these kids want more than anything else. They do not want surprises. They don't want somebody yelling and screaming at them. They want to come in every single day and find consistency, stability, predictability. And my example is when you go buy toothpaste, same brand, every time you squeeze it, you expect the same thing to come out. Same thing with cereal. Or you go to your favorite coffee shop or your restaurant. Why do you go to these businesses? Because they're consistent. You know what you're going to get. And so the good, effective teacher establishes a classroom that is consistent so that when these kids come to classroom, and many of them come from inconsistent, dysfunctional homes, they find consistency in your classroom and they love it.
What do you do when you have, for example, some kids who are really good at drawing and have terrible trouble with language, and some kids are just the opposite? There's so many different learning styles.
Okay. Learning style, believe it or not, is overrated. It's never been proven that it works. A good teacher doesn't worry too much about learning styles, because a good teacher will have all kinds of activities. As I said, your lesson plan will have all kinds of activities, and these activities will certainly meet whatever style that kid may have.
What are some examples of that?
Well, for many of these kids, they like to do things with their hands. Other kids, they would just like to curl up in a corner on a beanbag and read. See, and believe it or not, there are some people who love to just sit and listen. I'm the kind of a person who just loves and listen to people, because I can get a lot of information by listening to people.
are the causes of teacher burnout?
Very simple. They haven't learned how to teach. It has nothing to do with the kids. It has nothing to do with the parents. They haven't learned how to teach. Somehow, no one taught them how to teach. So I'm glad you've brought that subject up, because Rosemary and I are new teacher advocates, and we do a lot of writing on a thing called new teacher induction. And it's very sad that many school districts will hire a new teacher, throw them in a classroom, and say, good luck. You would never see that in the airline industry. Can you imagine being on an airplane, which you know the pilot has not received training?
Right.
I have a friend who owns three gas stations. And one day I said to him, you know that guy sitting in that little booth there? Does he receive any training, or she receive any training? He looked at me and said, of course. I said, how much? 12 hours over 1 week, you know, like 3-4 hours a day. And then during the year, the master company, you know, like Shell Gasoline, will come unannounced and see how that person is doing. And then if that person's not doing well, you know, we may have to let the person go, or we'll reteach them. Education does not teach teachers how to teach. That's sad.
So the teacher training courses and the degrees that people get in education aren't doing the job?
No, I'm not talking about the teacher education courses. I'm talking about what happens after a teacher hits the campus. We have two kinds of administrators. We have one who believe in magic bullets. That is, if they can just find the money or the program and a staff and put it into place, it will teach the kids. Programs don't teach kids. Money doesn't teach kids. Technology doesn't teach kids. Teachers teach kids. And the best kind of principal a teacher can find is what we call an instructional leader, someone who knows how to teach the teachers how to teach. And it's the lucky teacher who can be on a campus in which the principal knows how to teach and can teach you how to teach. And when they come Thursday, Friday, I will show them several examples of principals who teach teachers how to teach.
Let's say a new teacher is kind of thrown into the classroom and does not have the good luck to have a principal like that, or someone who is teaching them how to teach. What are some of the pitfalls that they fall into?
All the things I've mentioned, like they don't stand at the door to greet the kids. There's no agenda. They just cover the textbook. They're just going from day to day. There's no consistency. I was hoping you'd ask me just the opposite. And that is, and we hear from these teachers all the time. In fact, we just heard from one. We had something posted on Facebook. This teacher was lost, and then she wrote a thank you letter to us. So I was hoping you'd ask me, what happens to a new teacher who's lost? Is there any help for that teacher? And the answer is yes.
Well, that's why you wrote this book, first of all.
That's why we wrote the book. And also, we have a thing called teachers.net. We don't own it. Teachers with a plural, teachers.net. It's owned by two guys in San Diego, and for 11 years, Rosemary and I have been writing success stories on teachers.net. There's no preaching. There's no ideology. We find examples of principals and teachers and coaches who are very successful, and we tell you what they do, and we even allow you to link to what they're doing. You can copy and steal what they do. And so we've been able to help a lot of teachers survive and get out of that first year being lost. We show them what good teachers are doing. So I highly recommend maybe our book as well as teachers.net.
And of course, there's no shame in stealing other teachers' good ideas.
Oh, no. My lecture begins with steal. I say you use the case method. Copy and steal everything. But of course, as I say, it's not stealing. You go into a classroom and you ask teacher, may I have this? I have this. And I say to new teachers, you can always spot a good teacher. They're willing to share. And so when they come to hear us on Thursday, Friday, they'll find that for 3-4 hours, all we're going to do is share what good teachers and good principals have done. We're going to tell stories, and they're going to see examples of what good teachers and administrators do. And that's how they learn. They see how other people do things.
Are there any particular qualities that you think a person needs if they're going to be a teacher? For example, do you have to be an extrovert or something like that?
No. They have to be somebody who's willing to learn. Now, that may shock you, but I see teachers come, and immediately they sit in the last row. They turn on their cell phones, and you say, why are you here? You would never allow your kids in your classroom to do that, and yet you're here saying to me, I don't want to listen, I don't want to learn. And so I think the greatest quality of a teacher is to be able to be a learner.
Susan Herrera, so you are at the Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation and are sponsoring various educational initiatives here in New Mexico. How do they work? In other words, things that you've done in past years. Do you see teachers coming back and having more success with their students?
Oh, yeah. With the Increased Science Program, what we're seeing is double-digit gains in content knowledge for students and teachers alike. As far as teachers learning more about the science that they're teaching, let's face it, most elementary school teachers were not science majors. So they don't have a deep background in it, but we have found by using these science kits and doing a lot of teacher training, professional development in the summer, they really can understand deeply how to use it. They work at it over a three-year period. We don't expect everybody to be perfect the first year. It takes a lot to learn how to administer these kits, how to teach the science, also how to get the kids asking deep questions about what they're discovering. That is a process, and so we've told teachers when they begin this process, we don't expect everybody to do it totally right the first year. We said, let's take 3 years, let's see how we grow as a team over this period, and let's see if we're doing it. And lo and behold, it's been amazing. To see this real wealth of knowledge happen in the classroom.
May I say something about, she uses the word training. They're doing these wonderful workshops. That's the secret. You train and have teachers continue to learn. This month's Teachers.net article is about a coach in Philadelphia, and he makes this statement that I can only succeed if the teachers I coach are willing to be coached. That is, all teachers can be very effective, but they've got to be willing to learn how to be effective.
Do you find that there are some teachers who are put in the position of teaching, for example, elementary school science, but they're science phobic the way some people and some students even are math phobic?
Sure. We see that all the time. And we admit that. We said we know that the last thing you wanted really is a science kit on your desk. We get that. We get that we're asking you to really stretch and grow as a teacher. We hope you'll work with us. We understand that this isn't easy, but we also know that you'll probably be very successful, and so will your kids. And I think that has, in fact, happened with most teachers in this program.
You know, when you say science phobic, the teacher's really not science phobic. What the teacher's really saying is, I don't know much science background, and so I'm phobic. So I need some help. That's all. Just go out and help.
So you're treating the teachers in the same way that you're teaching the teachers to treat their own kids.
That's right. In fact, I tell new teachers, if you need help, write a great big Craigslist ad, post it in the faculty room that says, I'm new here, I need help. And you'll be shocked at how many teachers will come and help you.
Dr. Harry Wong is a teacher. He is the author, co-author with Rosemary Wong, of the book The First Days of School, How to Be an Effective Teacher. Susan Herrera is CEO of Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation, which is sponsoring the seminar.
Yes, it'll be held Thursday and Friday at the Buffalo Thunder Resort.
So today and tomorrow.
Today and tomorrow, yes. And
can people, if somebody's hearing this, can they just go
sure.
up there?
Sure, it's $70. That comes with a breakfast and lunch, and you get to hear Dr. Harry Wong and Rosemary in the morning, and then in the afternoon we have Dr. Jeff Goldstein. It should be a great day. It's from 8:30 to 3:30 in the afternoon, and people can register at the door.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And for more information, you can go to lanelfoundation.org.